Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-led Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Brian Seely is the president of Comparative Aircraft Flight Efficiency, Inc., CAFE. CAFE is the premier flight test agency for small personal aircraft. Since 1981, its volunteers have promoted the advance of aircraft efficiency through flight testing. It currently hosts the NASA Centennial Challenge for Aviation. CAFE developed award-winning flight test equipment and software that records extremely accurate speeds, temperatures, weights, pressures, frequencies, and sound levels. CAFE flight test expertise has become a national asset recognized by many of those prominent in the world of aviation, including the FAA, NASA, SAE, and EAA. CAFE aims to advance the science, education, and sustainability of personal aviation. Dr. Seely is also an ophthalmologist and has a medical degree from the University of California, San Francisco.
Thank you, Chisako. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm excited to present to you something that I'm very passionate about and that I think has great promise. Before I begin, I want to get a sense of you in the audience and your orientation and background. So let me ask, how many of you are private pilots? Okay, and how many of you believe there's a thing called global warming? Okay, and how many of you have been up in a small aircraft? Great. Okay. I'm going to remove this microphone so that I can stand and see my own slides. I don't think I really need to stand behind here. What I'm going to do in the talk is first give you a little background about the CAFE Foundation, because we're not really nationally prominent yet. I'll tell you a little bit about the global and other crises that are driving our work toward green aviation, our work with NASA. And then I'll get into specifics about the actual aircraft and what we propose to do. So to start with, why did NASA choose comparative aircraft flight efficiency up in Santa Rosa to be their small airplane flight test agency? Well, that's a very long story. Here you see one of the planes that we tested, the prototype Lancair Legacy, equipped with the CAFE recording barograph booms on each wingtip. These are very special devices that record altitude to within 6 inches, airspeed to within a tenth of a mile an hour, and temperature to within a tenth of a degree. This gives us extraordinary second-by-second averaging of flight data and lets us characterize airplanes very well. These are among the many things that our CAFE volunteers have done over the years. Starting in 1981, we did the CAFE 400 races, essentially a race in which we computed speed times miles per gallon times payload as the score. We developed a very sensitive set of scales that measure to 1/20th of a pound. They're built into the floor of the hangar. You can measure fuel consumption for a given flight to extreme accuracy with these scales. The barograph I just mentioned, a whole raft of other things that we have done over the years, including there at the bottom the Electric Aircraft Symposium, which is now in its third year and which is being coupled with the NASA Ames Research Center Symposium on Biofuels in 2010. This is how we started. Back in 1981, we started as a 501c3 nonprofit all-volunteer educational corporation in California. We were born up in Santa Rosa at the Charles M. Schultz Airport there. We've done a number of things, but since 2004, we've been a five-year Space Act agreement with NASA to conduct the flight testing of small airplanes. Here is our flight test center in Santa Rosa. It's a lovely country club home for me, outside of my medical practice. It's a remarkably equipped facility funded by the FAA and by the Experimental Aircraft Association, who gave us a large grant to build this center for flight testing. These are some of our volunteers at work. There you can see the scales built into the floor of the hangar. You can see us loading sand ballast into one of the test airplanes, building parts for our flight data recorders and so forth. We were recently invited down to the Dryden Flight Center to show them our flight test equipment and to essentially brainstorm with them how we were going to do this next aviation, future of aviation contest. Now I'm going to change gears and talk a little bit about the environment and some of the imperatives that are driving us to do what we do. I think we all understand now that we're starting to have to pay attention to nature. We're starting to have to look at the planet as a whole in all the things that we do, especially our industrial and transportation processes, in particular energy. The IPCC leader has told us that now is the time, that we have to get busy right now. And so the NASA project that CAFE has will be held in the summer of 2011, and we think we're going to see some remarkable results. So what we're looking at is how green aviation can have a role in global warming and the energy shortage, the global terrorism, transportation gridlock, and general aviation, which is really near collapse at this point. Here's a picture from Richard Heinberg's book, The Party's Over, showing that the so-called peak oil, at which we no longer can produce oil as quickly as the demand for it rises, is to happen sometime in perhaps 2010 or maybe out around 2015. Experts differ on this depending on how hard you scrape and scrounge to get oil out of shale and so forth. But we are looking at a real difficulty. I've just attended the NASA Green Aviation Workshop at Ames, where they presented to us the fact that not just major airlines, but the military as well, are beginning to really have concerns about our dependency on foreign oil to sustain the fleet of operations. And so a big push for synthetic fuels and biofuels is underway, and this is going to prove to be vital to maintaining the systems that we know. There's a huge effort in biomass. This, I believe, is going to devolve toward algae and so-called halophyte plants that can grow in brackish, salty water. These can regenerate quickly and generate something like 150 times the yield per acre from, say, corn or soy or switchgrass-produced biofuel. And there's a lot of promise in biomass, and many of you know that there's now a thing called life cycle assessment, which is looking at the entire process of developing a biofuel as opposed to developing a wind turbine or a photovoltaic solar farm, which is going to prove to be the greenest. Well, we're not sure yet, and so we're betting on all of them. Here's a slide from MIT that shows the very, very small part of our energy that is coming from renewable sources right now and how the vast majority of our energy is still coming from burning things, burning coal, gas, and oil, and how much we have to change this is enormous. Cars, I'm sure all of you who drive a car are familiar with scenes like this, but one of the things about gridlock is it's a problem that doesn't seem to go away, and it's because of the single-file nature of travel on surface roads. In Los Angeles Basin, there's a door-to-door trip speed average of 22 miles an hour projected for any trip across the LA Basin in the year 2010. So the freeway might say 65 miles an hour, but let's face it, it isn't. There are 6.7 billion gallons of fuel wasted each year by simply sitting in traffic jams. Freeways cost $20 million per mile. China is about to spend $1 trillion building roads across their nation. Here we see an excellent book called 2 Billion Cars, just out from Dr. Sperling up at UC Davis, and it shows that although our population is growing, the rate of vehicle miles driven and vehicle registrations is growing even faster. What are we going to do about this? The surface mobility solution strategies have all faced similar problems in that they intrude on that personal space and privacy that we all enjoy in our individual cars. And they're also subject to single file backups, and they essentially are trying to coerce us away from our personal travel. The big question is, will consumers take the lead in this or have to be coerced into these mass transit strategies? Again, I commend this book by Dr. Sperling to all of you, 2 Billion Cars. It's an excellent study of where we are right now with our transportation attempts. And again, Dr. Sperling points out that it's hard to get people to give up their cars, their personal transportation. It's also hard to get people to give up the thirst for excess power. We still, on the television and radio, hear ads that have revving engines and cars racing away and, you know, this one has more horsepower than that one and so forth. That mentality is very prevalent. And here we see some results from the past. Maybe these will become dinosaurs, but you can see the kind of fuel consumption that didn't seem to matter when energy was cheap and plentiful. And now we're starting to realize what has to be done. My dear wife, Anne, who's sitting up front here and without whom none of this could have happened, she and I took an adventure. We rented a Prius and drove from Santa Rosa to L.A. in a kind of a race. But the race was to load the vehicle with 800 pounds of sand, including us, and to drive it at 2 a.m. down to Los Angeles on I-5 and carefully use the cruise control exactly at the speed limit the whole trip and see how fast we could average and what was our fuel economy carefully measured. Well, this is what we scored, and 182 passenger miles per gallon, assuming four seats times 45 miles per gallon for the vehicle, that's pretty good. That's remarkable. That sets a fairly high bar. In fact, that was a determiner of NASA and CAFE saying that the Green Flight Challenge should demand 200 passenger miles per gallon. So that's the current hurdle that we've set for these aircraft. And that's a tall hurdle. There is a thing called the Automotive X Prize, the Progressive Automotive X Prize, that is demanding 100 miles per gallon per vehicle. Now, that is a multi-leg trip simulating urban and freeway driving, and the net speed on that contest is going to be about 19 miles per hour. It's not really a speed-dependent contest. We think that speed is important. We think people want to get there in a hurry, and we think the aircraft offers a real opportunity. The big dilemma is, how about this thing called a pilot's license? How big a hurdle is that standing in the way of a mass use of small airplanes? And I'll get to that. We think here in Northern California, this network of freeways that we have that are so often backed up can be skirted by flying through the air, because in the air, there's no limit to how many lanes the freeway can have, nor for that matter, how many layers of overpass you can have. And this concept of using aircraft instead of cars can extend your outreach to suburban areas, especially if the aircraft can land on a very small parcel, not require a long runway. General aviation, our particular area of passion, is in big trouble right now. It's in trouble to the same degree that General Motors and Chrysler are in trouble. And I think you all probably heard that today the announcement was made that it does not look as if General Motors is going to survive and that their bankruptcy is likely to actually take place next Monday. That could be a tie-in, by the way, to what we're doing here, the idea that they would build a new kind of vehicle. But in any case, general aviation is in trouble. It needs a shot in the arm. It needs a rebirth. And we think, again, that our project with NASA may offer that. In 2007, CAFE, seeing these things in development, decided to organize an event called the Electric Aircraft Symposium. And it was held here in San Francisco. And it was a very select group of very high-level NASA and industry people from Boeing and elsewhere. And by golly, we got together and decided that, yes, it really is time to start thinking about battery-powered flight. This event has grown every year. This year it was held at the Hiller Museum as a kind of in conjunction with the NASA Green Aviation Conference. And this thing is really taking off, and I'll show you how it ties into our competition. But the very concept, for example, that a farmer might have an aircraft, a very efficient aircraft, that they could recharge independently and travel without having to use dirt roads and go to wherever they want to go. This is really quite a radical idea, and again, I'm going to come back to the fact, how hard is it to fly that airplane? President Obama, as many of you heard, has announced that the nation that leads the world in creating new sources of clean energy will be the nation that leads the 21st century global economy. And he said that, by the way, again today, that same quote. Thomas Friedman, in his book, The Earth, The World is Flat, has called for a thing called Code Green, meaning that it is very urgent that we get busy and solve these problems. And so CAFE and NASA think that one way to really accelerate this progress is to have a contest that brings forth a really exciting new kind of vehicle, a must-have sort of vehicle. We think that a contest for exceptional green aircraft can give evolution a shove. We think there's a niche in which these vehicles can play a significant role. We think there are many different high technologies available today, and they simply haven't all been distilled into one vehicle yet. And we think that a technology prize is perhaps the ideal and fastest way to get there, rather than stimulus money or small company startups with risk and other things. We think a national showcase of what can be done is exactly the path to take. So to review, these are the many rationales for aiming toward a green competition. And I won't repeat them, but I think you're all aware of them. There are so many reasons to do this and so many upsides waiting for us that we are really excited about it. And just by way of relativity, consider what we're spending in our stimulus package and the Iraq War and everything else, and scale those billions to the 1.5 million that is being offered as a prize for the Green Flight Challenge. It begins to make you wonder if we're putting our money in the right places in the right amounts. This is a quote from Dennis Bushnell, NASA's chief scientist, and he compares the emergence of these new modern high-tech personal aircraft to the separation from mainframe computer of the widely, massively used laptop and desktop computer for personal computing. And I think this is a valid comparison. Now, how long it takes to get there is another matter. But we think an ideal technology prize, it needs to be transformative. It needs to open up a new paradigm of use. It needs to bring lots of teams, not just one. It needs to have advances that are relevant and useful, and hopefully will grow a new industry. So this is a sort of parody of the ideal personal aircraft. Just think of what these Japanese cranes can do. They can fly in any weather, here flying through the snow. They're self-piloted. They're short takeoff and landing, STOL, but they can go fast door to door. They're quiet. They're safe. They're environmentally friendly. They avoid traffic. They don't run into each other. They're self-aware. They know when they're tired and need to land. They're easy to use, and they occupy their own private space. So these principles are what we think a personal air vehicle ought to adhere to. And fortunately, NASA's been quietly leading the way in this. Back at NASA Langley, they have a thing called the ECFI, the Electronic Certificated Flight Instructor. That's basically like an airplane where when you fly the plane, there's a little guardian angel there built into the flight deck, and it warns you of hazard, and it prevents you from making mistakes. It steers you clear of mountains. It tells you when you're low on fuel. It even resists the stick as you try to turn into traffic or turn into a restricted airspace. It fights you with a shaking, pushing action. These kinds of technologies can make flying tremendously safer. And perhaps a stick-type operation of a vehicle will even find its way into cars as the new paradigm. This is the new Mercedes. A fellow named John Thornburg, who is a very renowned flight instructor, was asked to come up with a list of all the things it would take to make flying accessible the way a DMV driver's license is accessible. He said this is what we have to put into the airplane. And I'm going to take the time to go through these so you understand. Automated diagnostics, that is, the airplane pre-flights itself. It has the sensor technology to know whether it's really ready and safe to fly. It has ECFI with voice alerts, avoidance of traffic, etc. It has electronic stall proofing, so it can't stall and enter a spin. Voice recognition commands by the pilot. The automatic power setting and propulsion monitoring. You don't have to be an engine, combustion engineer to know how to manage the power plant. It's all done automatically. On-demand usurpation of control command by a smart autopilot. If the pilot appears to be incapacitated or moving toward the White House or the Pentagon like a terrorist might, the autopilot can take over, or even some ground-based control like a UAV can take over and fly that plane. Or, for that matter, can remotely activate the rooftop vehicle parachute and pop the plane out of the sky. Sensor technology is very advanced with GPS and ADS-B radar sensitivities and traffic management. Autonomous flight. Many of you may be aware that Stanford won the DARPA challenge a couple of years ago with a vehicle that was able to drive itself around a town. It could see the trees and the curbs and the pedestrians and all other obstacles, and it simply navigated as if it were being driven. And the wonderful thing about it is that the vehicle learned how to do that by simply copying a human driver, and it had smart software that was learning software that enabled it to quickly get quite good at that. Automatic takeoff and automatic landing are the two big tough ones. And then, of course, how to interface all these vehicles with air traffic control is another big hurdle. This is a picture of our Santa Rosa Airport that comes right off of Google Earth. This is one of the keystones of what's called synthetic vision. And synthetic vision is this sort of thing. You can simply, in all weather, in clouds, in rain, in the dark, have presented to your computer screen this view of what to fly. And all of us should be able to fly the stick and keep the plane inside this tunnel. By the way, this tunnel, this wormhole through the sky, expressly designed so that it never intersects with another airplane. The great master computer on the ground is keeping track of where you are, where everyone else is, and you have your very own freeway lane to your destination. That, by the way, is a simulation that my son created, and it was so popular that it's been adopted by the Boeing Phantom Works people as the new decluttered presentation for synthetic vision. So we're very proud of that. Now, the reason I show this picture is to remind everyone that not only do birds exhibit their own personal space, you'll notice there's a little space between each bird up there, but also that if something were to scare these birds, they would all take off every which way, and they wouldn't run into each other. Now, how do they do that? And how will we do that when we want to have numerous vehicles in the sky? Well, a study was done by a battlefield simulation company. What would it look like if we filled the sky with vehicles? And here it is. This is 10,000 personal air vehicles flying over New York, and every one of those vehicles is avoiding each other by simple see and avoid. They're not flying in computerized tunnels. They're not on automatic guidance. Their simulation is simply a competent pilot looking out for others. And this model shows that the sky will hold 700 times more airplanes than it has now with no conflict using simple see and avoid. Now, that's very impressive, but the really impressive thing is what happens if you now implement the automated tunnel so that the guidance doesn't depend upon the eyes, ears, brains, and movements of a pilot, but instead is just stay in that tunnel and you'll be fine. This goes up by another two orders of magnitude. So you see, thanks to the multiple layers of sky and the great breadth of sky that's out there, it's a medium in which you can travel without obstruction and without the limitations of single file. Now we come to some of the aeronautical considerations, and those of you who love airplanes will like this part the best. These two very different airplanes here have very different lift-to-drag ratios. The lift-to-drag ratio represents for an airplane its glide ratio. Okay, so the little RV-8 kit plane there has a glide ratio of about 12 to 1. If it's 1 mile high, it'll glide 12 miles with no engine. However, the Antares glider down there, it has a glide ratio of about 60 to 1. Now, that means that if that airplane is a mile above San Francisco, it can glide all the way to Santa Rosa. Here are some lift-to-drag values for various vehicles. And you'll see that aviation seems to be at a disadvantage. But we get to go direct, nonstop, without the twisty road, without the traffic backup. It's apparent, obviously, why we haul heavy freight in railroad cars. 3,000 to 1 lift-to-drag ratio for a giant steel wheel on a hardened steel track. You can see that among the aircraft, we have an opportunity to do a lot better than the typical Cessna. And that's what got us excited. That's the part that made us realize that we could have a green aviation contest. Here you see, on the upper left, the Sunseeker, an airplane entirely powered by solar energy. The airplane flew from Los Angeles to Atlanta, clear across the nation, never plugged in to recharge, never put a drop of gasoline in the plane, made the entire trip on nothing but sunlight. Now, of course, didn't fly at night. The other airplane is a similar concept, obviously flying in a very sunny place where the solar cells are performing at their best. This is an exciting concept. It's definitely going to be a part of the Green Flight Challenge. Here is the Green Flight Challenge goals in a nutshell: reduce greenhouse gas emissions, advance renewable energy, and enable safe, efficient, distributed air travel to a large segment of the population. Here's what we have to work with. NASA has a kitty of $1.65 million that will be awarded in summer 2011 to the greenest airplane. What is the greenest airplane? Well, we're going to find out. We've opened the competition to university teams. We've already received letters of intent from several universities, and there'll be many more. The concept here is that we're trying to get multiple advances in green technology, a contest that's fair and accurate, relevant and useful, a showcase of the possibilities to spark more investment and interest in green vehicles, a dynamic event and a rallying point for green technology. Here's the rule that we have as a working set. Now, you may be a little daunted by that mathematical formula, but let me just point out that it's nothing more than a reciprocal relationship, so that as your miles per hour goes very, very large, then that number becomes very, very small. So it's a diminishing returns concept. And this makes sense because the difference between going from Santa Rosa to San Francisco at 100 miles an hour versus 400 miles an hour is only a few minutes. And so jacking up the speed to ridiculous levels that require huge amounts of power doesn't make sense and should not be rewarded. A similar thing is true of miles per gallon. We do not want a plane with infinite miles per gallon to necessarily be an automatic slam dunk winner. Because, again, think about it, the difference between 400 miles per gallon going to Los Angeles, say, on 1 gallon, which costs you $2.50, or doing it on 4,000, let's say, miles per gallon, a tenth of a gallon, well, the tenth of a gallon, you know, only saves you $2.30 or whatever it is. The scale of achievement has to be proportional to practical use. So that's why the formula is designed that way. And there is a fundamental threshold that says you cannot win the money unless you achieve 200 passenger miles per gallon. And the little MPGE has a reason. The E stands for equivalency, because we have to draw an equivalency between electricity and the BTUs in liquid fuel. And I'll get to that in a minute. And to distinguish these vehicles from cars and to account for the time it takes to park at an airport and get a Hertz car or ride a bicycle or a golf cart to grandma's front door, you have to go 100 miles an hour. Less than that is too much like a car. We think we're going to see some spectacular scores from the vehicles. We've limited them to a 52-mile-an-hour stall speed so that they can operate from small airports, small acreage. Land is scarce. Land is expensive. Communities don't want to give over land to airports unless they're small and unless the airplanes are quiet. So there is, not shown here, a 78 decibel noise limit on all these vehicles. If they break that noise limit, they're disqualified. They must, quote unquote, race for 200 statute miles. And they have to have realistic seating. They have to have an FAA license. The handling qualities of the plane have to be safe and evaluated by a test pilot before they're eligible. And they must have a so-called ballistic vehicle parachute. If you don't know what that is, in the rooftop of small airplanes, it's now possible to put a small rocket. Attached to the rocket is a parachute. And with a push-button operation, the rocket will shoot the parachute canopy high up behind the plane. It will inflate, and the plane will gently settle to Earth with nobody getting hurt. In fact, even the airplane may not be hurt. This is a radical new technology, but it offers tremendous safety. There's already been over 200 aircraft saved by this technology. Now, I mentioned BTU per gallon or BTU per kilowatt hour. This is perhaps the one remaining sticking point before this contest is approved by NASA. We're within probably days of being able to officially announce this contest. The problem is that there's a sort of preconditioning of the electrical energy. When a coal-fired power plant produces electricity and sends it out to your wall socket, that consumption of coal should probably be accounted for. On the other hand, if you charged up your electric airplane from your own wind turbine or from your own solar photovoltaic farm, then you didn't really burn any greenhouse gas to get your fuel. So that's the dilemma. We're considering whether or not to distinguish that, whether or not to account for the BTUs consumed in producing the electricity in the first place. But in any case, we're going to score the airplanes basically on how many BTUs they burn in a 200-mile race while getting over 100 miles per gallon. And we think we're going to see a score somewhat like that at the bottom. We think we may see a vehicle with 500 passenger miles per gallon at 100 miles an hour. That's pretty sensational. This racing that we're talking about here is like any sort of racing where to win, you have to do everything right. Colin Chapman, the great chief designer for Lotus Racing, believed in these aspects, that the ideal racing car was the one that was so built to purpose that as it crossed the finish line in first place, it broke into a million pieces. Now, I don't think we want to see that at our race, but it gives you a little sense of the kind of extreme, sharp pencil calculation that we think some of these teams will engage in. The team will need experts in all these areas and have to converge all these technologies to the ideal vehicle. And they'll have to have low drag, high gas mileage, safe handling, high lift devices which allow them to stall at 52 miles an hour and still have small wing area, and a vehicle parachute with an FAA license. Well, here's some really good news, and many of you know this already, that just to someone working in their garage, there's accessible today computerized fluid dynamics and 3D mapping, high-tech fiberglass and carbon fiber composite materials and resins, numerically controlled mills, commercial off-the-shelf automotive parts such as that one, which is a fly-by-wire throttle out of a Saab car. And then there's CAFE's website, which has this tremendous library of reference material on how to make your plane a better candidate. And then, of course, the universities can convene their several faculty departments, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, aeronautical, all of those grad students getting together to make an ideal vehicle. Job one in the race plane has got to be skeletal efficiency. The lighter the plane, the better the gas mileage, and the better everything. And getting a really ideal skeleton structure for the airplane is going to be key. In addition, as I mentioned, the high lift-to-drag ratio is going to be a major determiner of the gas mileage of the plane. Here's a picture of a perhaps lowest ever drag coefficient body tested in the wind tunnel up at University of Washington. And this shape may be the shape that people choose for their people enclosure. It draws on a thing called Goldschmied propulsion, which was a concept explored by Dr. Goldschmied back in the 70s and 80s, and remarkably found that you could get a body like this if you treated it just right and had an annulus of air intake at the rear of the body, that you could get a body like this to have almost zero drag or even thrust. This is an extremely low-drag racing plane, perhaps one of the lowest drag ever built. It's an example of the exotic and extreme streamlining we may see. Here's a Goldschmied body that is a people enclosure mounted underneath a laminar flow wing that could be a very, very efficient vehicle. I mentioned the high lift devices and the low stall speed. One of the things that the vehicles will have to do is find a way to take the onrushing air and throw it downward to enhance their lift. That way, with minimal wing, they can still get as slow as 52 miles an hour and into the small airport. There's an example of the Boeing C-17 with tremendous flaps on the wing. Some may choose to have flap enhancers that are nothing more than parachute fabric between an extendable segment in the wing. Here's our concept, our ideal, which is land your personal air vehicle at a very small airport close to town, literally walk to grandma's house, the smallest environmental footprint imaginable when done on emission-free, self-produced electrical energy. Packaging people is another issue we could not ignore. You can't have a contest in which some people fly a skinny torpedo rocket and others fly a full lush cabin. So we had to specify the compartment. And this is an example of a very well done compartment. This is the specification for our contest where you must have a reasonable headroom, reasonable legroom, and a certain width, meaning 20 inches at the elbows for all occupants. And I'm almost done. I want to finish up by talking about this vehicle parachute, a thing so important we considered it essential and required it. And then solar power, which many of you know can generate remarkable amounts of energy. The solar cells keep getting better. A biodiesel hybrid, there does exist a small engine like this that would be enough to propel an airplane. So we think that the Green Flight Challenge can truly be a crucible for combining green technologies, a thrilling event, one that may actually offer a path for GM to build some new vehicles. We think that this could have follow-on events that would change the metric or change the goal and push the technology further. And we remind you that anything new like this in the beginning may be ridiculed, it may be subverted by its competitors, but once it becomes popular enough to be affordable like cell phones, it becomes indispensable. Finally, I'll say that the Green Flight Challenge is looking for a name sponsor, and this is an opportunity, we think, for a long-term connection between a major company, a major corporation that wants to be forever remembered as having brought forth the greenest vehicles that we've ever seen. And so in closing, I'll remind you all that these urgencies we face are very real and that we better get busy. And here is our website, and there are available there the detailed rules draft if any of you care to submit comments. Thank you very much.
To remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to the Green Aviation Challenge with Dr. Brian Seeley. Our thanks to Dr. Seeley for his comments here today. I am Chisako Res, chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. We have a standing microphone here, and if you have questions, please line up behind the microphone. Well, shall I just pass around the microphone? Which one is better? Your preference? Pass around, okay. So any questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone. Question?
So I'm curious, what's the next step after you've crowned a champion? What's the next step in commercialization? What are the next steps you have to go through to start to realize this goal of mass transit via personal air vehicles?
Well, that's a key question, a very good question. What is the next step beyond a winner? And it's something that we're looking at. We're looking at the possibility of extending in year two or year three, demanding a greater range or perhaps demanding higher speeds, or perhaps demanding that the aircraft demonstrate the ability to fly the race autonomously with an advanced flight deck. What are the ingredients necessary for this to take hold, for this to gain traction in an industrial sense? And that's a little uncertain right now, because just the mere achievement of extreme mileage and speed may not be the only criteria necessary for popularity. There may be one or two or three, you know, people who insist with the winning team, please build me one of those, I'll pay you for it. But to take the approach toward production is a tricky matter that we're very open to suggestion.
Questions?
Recently, there's been a lot of the LSA aircraft. How close to what you're doing do those aircraft come to basically to what you're going for?
It's another excellent question, that the light sport aircraft movement is becoming perhaps the essential core of the world of sport and recreational aviation. That's how it began. That's its target audience. Whether it will expand into the domain of transportation machinery is a key question. And those vehicles in general have limitations upon them that prevent them from being extreme high-mileage vehicles. There is a movement now, in fact, a dedication at the national level of the Experimental Aircraft Association to bring forth electric-powered, clean, green LSAs. And you're going to hear more about that probably at this year's Oshkosh Air Show. It's an area that they believe essential to the future of sport and recreational aviation, that simply put, these LSAs cannot go on putting out hydrocarbons or using non-green fuels and expect to survive with the imperatives that we're increasingly faced with.
I have two questions for you, but I want to congratulate you for coming to the Commonwealth Club. I just think it's marvelous. Are you based in Santa Rosa, or is that your base?
Yes.
And supposing that you had, just in your imagination, you had a sales force that was able to provide you with a tremendous amount of money so that you wouldn't have to think about money. Do you think that then that could make a big difference in your pursuit of this adventure?
Well, that's another very good question. People may wonder, why do the team of CAFE volunteers put such effort into this? Because we are all volunteers, we all have day jobs, and what is driving us? I would say that number one driver is the opportunity to go to a facility like the CAFE Flight Test Center and have brought before you some of the most sensational vehicles imaginable, and to get your lay your hands on them, remove the cowling, install your test equipment, see them fly, ride in them, etc. It's a wonderful zookeeper's job. But in addition, the organization sees itself as capable of more than that. That is, we have this wonderful, elaborate flight test equipment. We need an aircraft. We need one of these modern green airplanes on which our organization can extend its testing and proving and new ideas and so forth. The funding level necessary to bring about that sort of thing and run these contests is probably on the order of $500,000. And so it's not a huge amount compared to the importance of what we think might be coming out of this. The contest prize being about $1.5 million, that's being debated right now within NASA. There's a new leader at NASA who's dedicated to providing more funding for aeronautics. The new Obama administration, of course, is more interested in green technology. So we do not know about what will happen there. But our goal, of course, is to carry this on and to get CAFE the sustaining funding that it needs to keep this going. And certainly, if a corporate sponsor wants to come in and either just kind of vicariously enjoy the fact that NASA's putting up the prize money, or add to that prize money, or split the contest into one side electric, one side biofuel, there's a number of possibilities that exist there, all of them probably worth looking at. Yes?
I have a question. I have the mic. I'm working in the electric vehicle space and on conversions, retrofits, and things like that. And the huge issue is safety testing. It becomes like super expensive for these small companies to deal with that. So I just wonder how these guys will deal with it in the competition. Is there similar safety testing regulations that they have to deal with? And then I also wonder on the funding side, if you did look at stimulus funding as a possibility, or Richard Branson as a corporate sponsor.
We've we've begun to explore that, and we've had interest from General Electric and Boeing and Google and others. I'm not sure who will become the name branded sponsor for Green Flight Challenge. We would love to have someone come along and help us turn it into what we want it to be. The question about vehicle safety is a very key one, and we've explored this a great deal. In fact, it's been the principal component that delayed us announcing this prize a year ago, was going through the legal system to explore what safeguards have to be applied to this race so that you minimize the chance of a problem, you minimize the incident risk, and you have all the vehicles as safe as they can be so that they're that much closer to becoming production vehicles, while at the same time recognizing we can't test for everything. We can't do the kind of exhaustive certification that the FAA will demand of a certificated machine. And there's a number of issues you well know about batteries and battery temperature control and so forth in electric vehicles. These are all significant issues because, again, this is racing, and some of these batteries are going to be extremely exotic. And compared, for example, to the Tesla sports car battery pack of 135 watt-hours per kilogram, we are going to see 4 and 5 times that level of energy density packed into these racers. And so we're producing what's called a battery registry, which means here is the list of approved batteries with which you may race. We're not going to allow so-called grenade batteries or batteries that can only be used twice before they're totally spent and consume themselves, or batteries that don't have essentially a kind of production certificate behind them.
I'm an ex-combat pilot scientist, so I have a couple questions on things that may be obstacles. One is that only 1% of people who start pilot training courses actually get a license. Could this be a problem?
It's perhaps the biggest problem. It's the core problem. Anyone who looks at the current daunting task of getting a private pilot's license, not an LSA license, but a private pilot's license, will find that it's very demanding. It's a complex, multitasking, and expensive undertaking. It will cost $7,000 to $10,000 to get a license. It's not at all like a car license. We think that the advanced flight deck technology, sensor technology, pilot assistance, essentially the electronic certificated flight instructor, could tremendously simplify the need of getting a license to the level where not only is it more affordable and doesn't take 50 hours, but instead takes maybe 7 to 10 hours of instruction, but that it's safer, and that this is a tall order. It's not necessarily tied to the extreme greenness of the vehicle, but it's a core ingredient, and we're paying attention to it.
Another problem might be space for airports. You mentioned here the city was unable to get approval for another runway at SFO. The biggest cities in the world only have one GA airport. We have San Carlos, New York has Teterboro. If this is going to be a mass transit program, you're going to need a lot more airports in a basically airport-unfriendly world.
Another excellent question, and in fact, the RhinoCorp study on air density looked at the fact that core metropolitan areas such as Chicago, New York, and San Francisco may take advantage of something called the barge airport, that is, a 1,000 or 1,500-foot barge in the bay adjacent to the financial district on which quiet, almost silent electric aircraft can come and go and not disturb anybody, and parking may be an issue. They can fold their wings. But this sort of scenario may be a solution for the extremely dense urban setting. In addition, the STOL, short takeoff and landing capability, is a core ingredient here because land costs are such that communities will not allocate the space for an airport, setting aside the noise. Even if the vehicles are totally silent, you won't get funding for the space unless it's a small space. And we have now down to something on the order of 12 acres as being the basic core landing facility for this kind of personal air vehicle. Well, 12 acres, compare that to a general aviation airport like Santa Rosa, which is over 1,000 acres. 12 acres versus 1,000 acres. You begin to see that the opportunity could be there. In fact, alongside every 300-yard golf driving range, there could be a strip adequate for this sort of vehicle to touch down silently, as long as no one's swinging their golf club.
And my last question is government approval of the design. I've spoken to people like Boeing. It takes a decade to get a new airplane design approved by the government. Do you envision this starting out as a kit airplane for a hobbyist license as sort of a shortcut?
That's another great question, because we have in this country an almost unique opportunity through our FAA for what are called amateur-built experimental aircraft, so that the light sport aircraft, the amateur-built experimentals, can get a license. They can get a license to be built in your garage or built by a kit manufacturer, and they are not only affordable thanks to not having to be certified, but they can be quite sophisticated with today's technology and science. So I think there's a kind of foot-in-the-door opportunity there. You could imagine, for example, a winning airplane that turned into a kit airplane, that turned into a light sport aircraft, a showroom-type airplane, not certificated, not licensed for IFR, but gradually becoming so popular that the core, you know, snowball effect would allow it to reach certification and become popularized. Yes, again, we mentioned that building roads costing $20 million per mile beyond the means of many non-affluent nations, and yet they have remote areas in which there's need of medical relief and other things. This could, again, with a 12-acre plot, allow these kinds of vehicles to bring in supplies, rescue people, all sorts of assistance in the third world, and do so while still being green.
Yeah, what's the PMPG for commercial airliners?
Good question. Recently, Bob Hendricks back at NASA Glenn sent me an email in which he claimed it was on the order of 80 to 100. Now, that includes a computation of occupancy. I think he said 75% occupancy at that level. And the new Boeing Dreamliner, a 787, is going to be at the top of that class. So in round numbers, this green contest is aiming for twice the efficiency of the best airliner.
Of all the engineering challenges you're going to face in this airplane creating or winning this contest, which do you think is the most daunting? Propulsion, airframe, safety? Which is the problem that has to be the biggest problem to solve, and why?
Well, the one that steps out prominently is going to be battery energy density. The pure electric aircraft at this point has an edge because its motor can be 95% efficient. And if it can use those electrons at a 95% efficiency, then the task is merely to get enough battery to go 200 miles. And if the battery energy densities that we're beginning to hear about are with us and ready to put in the plane by summer 2011, I think that's going to be the key. I think the sailplane industry, the open class, super efficient sailplanes, they've already explored and optimized things like supreme high lift to drag ratios, supreme laminar flow, lightweight carbon structures, etc. I think the electrical engineering department at the universities is going to be the lead player in team importance.
Unfortunately, we have time for one last question.
Hi, thank you. That was very interesting. Do you welcome the public to visit your place in Santa Rosa when you are testing some of these vehicles that will be coming through or putting the instruments on them?
We have sessions in which we're open to the public. We've had open house events. In general, the facility is only open to so-called race volunteers. So in the first two NASA prize contests that we've conducted, two of them now, the 2007-2008 events, you could sign up as a volunteer and get an official T-shirt and come out onto the ramp and be amongst the teams and be a chaperone or a sandbag loader or a number of things and be right in the thick of it. But there was no grandstand spectator facility. Our hopes are that with this event, we'll actually have telemetry in the vehicles like NASCAR, and there'll be a jumbotron for spectators to see just where each vehicle is on the race course.
Well, thanks to Dr. Seeley for his comments here today, and thank you for your questions from the audience. And we also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.